Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm Josh Sepps, filling in for Philip Adams for the next 3 weeks. If you have spent the afternoon, the way I have, scurrying between antique furniture stores, buying up old government filing cabinets, in the hope of scoring a swag of secret documents, relax, the hunt is over. We have tonight, just for you, a trove of amazing cloak and dagger tales of Russian spooks in the UK. Not actually during the Cold War, when you might expect to find your run-of-the-mill Russian spook in the UK, but in the earliest days of the Soviet Union, in the jazz age of the 1920s. Those Ruskies were fighting it out with proto-James Bonds in the posh restaurants and hotels of London, and their tales are recounted in a book that is, in a strange way, surprisingly relevant today in this era of the concerns about the deep state and alleged Russian interference in certain US elections. I'll speak with the historian Tim Phillips about his book, The Secret Twenties, in the second half of the show. But first, what, of course, is the point in even having these elections for the Russians to interfere in if we're only voting between Tweedledum and Tweedledee? From Trump to Brexit to Australia's revolving door of prime ministers, voters are obviously fed up. They're fed up with what? What is the core problem here? Because it depends who you ask. A left-winger might say, well, the problem is rampant capitalism, inequality, environmental destruction, economic injustice. A conservative might say, well, it's more about the loss of community and the loss of faith and family and self-reliance, these kinds of cultural problems. My first guest thinks that the problem is a lot bigger than either side understands, that it's a problem with the whole ideological framework that we're all swimming inside. His book is called Why Liberalism Failed. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame in the United States. Patrick Deneen, welcome to LNL.
Thanks very much. Happy to be there. I wish I were there.
It's certainly a lot warmer than it probably is in Indiana in the United States in February, I imagine.
Absolutely. But I'm happy to be speaking with you.
Yeah, let's start with some definitions. What are you talking about when you say liberalism?
Sure. Well, in the American context, person would automatically think of the political left of our spectrum. It might be a little bit different in Australia. But
yeah,
I'm
use the more, of, a more European term.
You're right. I'm speaking really of a much much deeper and more pervasive and comprehensive idea that has its roots in philosophical developments 500 years ago. But we could look at the philosophy, for example, of John Locke, the British political philosopher, who posits that by nature human beings are in a condition of freedom, of sort of equal freedom, and imagines that this is a kind of state of nature, but what in fact the liberal political project proposes is to make us into those creatures, is to use especially what you were just talking about, the tools of the state and the market and a kind of transformation of society to create us into those equally free, autonomous, detached, increasingly solitary individuals that's imagined in the state of nature. And so what I'm arguing is that many of our social pathologies and political pathologies are not the result of a failure or shortcoming of this liberal political project, but in some ways the realization of its very success.
Wouldn't a classical liberal or what we might call today a libertarian say, well, John Locke didn't want to use the power of the state to coerce anybody to be a liberal or anything else. All he wanted to do was for the state to allow people to go about their business.
Right. Well, I mean, actually, of course, Locke did believe in a fairly powerful state, and many classical liberals do as well. They just think that it should be limited in terms of what it does. And one of the things that it does is actually is to help structure and create a market system, and indeed a market system that becomes larger and more comprehensive, and ultimately the vision would be that it becomes a global economic order. So in fact, what we typically think, and I think you're describing this in your lead-in, that there's a kind of division between the sort of statist vision and the free market vision. In fact, what we see around the world is that these two things, in a sense, grow together. The state becomes more powerful. The market becomes more comprehensive and powerful. And as a result, what we see around the world today is in the most developed liberal democracies, a sense of powerlessness among the citizenry from the very tools that were supposed to liberate them.
it sort of depends on our definition of liberation, right? I mean, you're right to catch me up on the point about John Locke, because of course, if you were to steal something or steal someone else's property in a libertarian idyll, then the state wouldn't seem powerless at all. It would throw the full weight of the court, of the justice system and the courts behind you, and presumably lock you up. So it depends on whether or not, I suppose, my question is: are both sides of politics liberal in your sense, in that they both focus on securing some kind of rights of the individual, but for conservatives it's property rights, and for progressives maybe it's more cultural or civil rights?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that in a sense our debates, and what you're describing is true in Australia, is certainly the case in the United States, our debates are within, in a sense, within the sort of order of liberalism. And so it tends to be two sides of the same coin that are arguing really over means. What's the best means of achieving this end of the liberated self? And that our conservatives tend to argue it's the market. Our liberals tend to argue, no, it's the state. And what we tend not to notice is that both sides, in a sense, always win their respective argument. The state grows larger, the market increases and becomes more encompassing. And in a sense, you could say the non-liberal side of their position. So in the case of the conservatives, the idea that we should retain family values, what you began by talking about, community, a strong sense of membership in sort of our private lives. And the liberal side, that the state should be involved in much more regulation of the economy. In a sense, those sides tend not to win. And so what we see is a kind of a ratchet movement that always increases the liberal nature of our lives in sort of all of its respects. And again, we're seeing, I think, the culmination of the very success of this project today.
I mean, definitionally, if what you're saying is that it's liberal when conservatives win and enact their policies, and it's liberal when progressives win and enact their policies, then it reminds me a little bit, and I felt this when reading your book, of the old gag about the young fish who are swimming along, and an old fish swims past them and says, "How's the water today, guys?" And they swim along, and after a minute, one of the young fish turns to the other one and says, "What's water?" It's like we're all in the liberalism that you're describing so much that I found on each page myself having to wrench my brain out of so many assumptions. How do you make that imaginative leap to step outside things that we all take for granted?
Well, it's funny. I actually begin every semester in my class telling that exact story. So if my students listen to this program, they'll say, "You must have been in my class."
I'm so predictable. I apologize.
I do tell them that it's a very old story, but it's always worth remembering. Well, for me, of course, I'm a professor of political philosophy, and so I'm in a sense always living in some ways outside of the fishbowl, because I'm reading texts that are very old, I'm reading arguments about systems that are very different or assumptions of human nature that are very different. I'm also very fond of the political thinker Alexis de Tocqueville, who famously comes to America in the 1830s and writes a book called Democracy in America. And his model was really to say, I can see America better than Americans can because I'm seeing it from outside. And so a challenge, it seems to me, for a form of deep political analysis is it possible to stand outside of ourselves and to understand the deeper phenomena that's happening, that's creating this context that we tend to think is only at the level of superficial daily partisan politics? Is there a kind of deeper dynamic that's unfolding that reflects the sort of foundational ideas of our societies?
Well, let's look to the ancients then. What did liberty mean in the ancient world? Maybe that's a place to stand in order to perceive ourselves.
So what we see, for example, in the thought of John Locke, earlier Thomas Hobbes, is a definition of liberty that I think most modern people would sort of intuitively say is true, that liberty is the freedom to act and to do as one wishes without any external impediment or obstacle. So it's a kind of what would be called a kind of negative liberty, the freedom to do as one wishes. In the classical context, and this would be true also in the Christian context, liberty is the condition that one achieves when one has ordered one's life in accordance with a conception of virtue or good living, or the good itself. And so if given a choice between something that's good for you and something that's bad for you, you're only living a condition of liberty when you're doing that which is according to the good of human living. And so just to give an example, Plato argues that the person who simply pursues material desires without limit, kind of you could say today's consumer, is actually in a condition of servitude, because that person can never be satiated. One will always be subject to the desires of material things or for material things. And so it clashes with the idea that freedom is doing what we want, because in the classical understanding, freedom is a kind of condition of self-discipline and self-mastery.
It sounds to me like what you're talking about really is the bad use of freedoms that liberalism has given us. It's possible to lead an introspective, self-disciplined life without being forced to do so, surely.
Right. And I think, for example, Aristotle would say it would be a pointless thing to simply try to force people to live according to virtue. Rather, society has to be in some ways ordered toward that end. And so he gives the example, for instance, that those people who are ungoverned in the matters of, he says, food and sex, for example. I'll take the example of food since it's sort of less controversial. If one is undisciplined in the matter of food, one will live an unhappy life. Really, we can see that today, right? If you don't have a good diet, things won't end well for you. You'll become obese and unhealthy and so forth. So our appetite says, yes, eat as much as possible. But our but we know from our nature that that's not a good thing for us, that it's not good simply to eat without limit. That's not a matter that can necessarily be dictated through government or through law, but it is something that can be governed by sort of social, we could say sort of social norms, a kind of a broader context that encourages us to adopt as almost a matter of unthinking, unreflective norms and ways of living that we understand that this is how we should order our lives.
How would you foster those outside of a liberal order in which people were able to use the tools of persuasion and education without free from interference by the state or by the market? I mean, it sounds like a little bit what you're talking about is the concept of nudging people in the correct direction, right? The behavioral psychology idea that we all know that, for example, if you are working for an employer and they enroll you automatically into some kind of a superannuation or what you would call a retirement fund, then you're much, much more likely not to opt out of it, even if you have the right to, rather than if they automatically opt you out of it and then you have to opt into it. So these small tweaks that we can make to our daily lives, and this is something that there's a lot of talk about in Silicon Valley at the moment as well, about whether or not our apps and our devices should be tailored in ways that give us more autonomy and give us more self-empowerment and more creativity to own our own existences. Why do you have to step outside of a liberal political environment in order to pursue that ownership?
So this is one of the fascinating paradoxes, is that the condition that has to in some ways be eventually created or fostered in order for us to achieve this experience of our liberty as equally free and equal individuals in this kind of, in now this civilized form of the state of nature, this ideal vision of what human life is, requires the kind of disassembling of, we could say, the thick fabric of culture that was, we could say, once the pervasive norm of human societies. In the book, I describe how liberalism in many ways fosters a kind of anti-culture, that is to say, a kind of absence of the bottom-up organic norms that were formed in families and communities and passed on from one generation to the next. Now, of course, these can themselves be pathological, but these are also ways in which we sort of swim in a kind of water that orders and governs us through norms, social norms, and familial norms. And so it's interesting that when I mentioned this idea of governing our appetites, the first thing you mentioned was how governments or larger institutions can create nudges for us. And it does reflect the sort of absence or the breakdown of these more cultural forms of norms that we could look to as the sort of what was once sort of the default way in which this form of we could say, educative formation would have taken place. In a sense, then, we have to look increasingly to government to afford those forms of governance, we could say.
No, I mean,
and so
I
the irony, right? So the irony again is that here in this condition of freedom, we require more and more government to fill in where there was once, we could say, and I don't mean to be nostalgic, but where government was supposed to, in some ways, be limited, we see a kind of an increase in its size, scope, and scale in our lives.
I appreciate that it's a less than ideal circumstance, but I fear I'm reminded of Churchill's line that democracy is the worst political system apart from all of the others. In the instances in the past when what you call cultural forms of norm enforcement were predominant, many people would regard those forms of those societies as being stultifying, as providing no possibility for people who were of alternative sexualities or genders or races. They were closed societies, and when there were cultural norms enforced, for example, by religious institutions, that provided even less of a possibility for self-fulfillment than current liberal societies do. Which do you prefer?
Well, I guess I would, in the first instance, say that we should be wary of self-congratulation about the openness of our societies. At least in the context of the American political, social, and economic context, what we're seeing is that there's a small proportion of the population that seems to be really enjoying this life of openness in this kind of global market in the urban environments where you have to be usually quite wealthy or on the way to being wealthy to enjoy those places. And then we have a very large proportion of our population that is living in a condition of this anti-culture that is not doing especially well. And so in a way you could say they're living in the worst of both worlds. It's sort of a closed condition with relatively little opportunities, but also with the dissipation of those cultural norms and traditions that once would have given more structure to their family lives and their communities. And I think this is where you're seeing a lot of the blowback and the negative reaction to sort of the elites of society in this populist movement that we're seeing around the West. So it seems to me that we tend to describe the lives enjoyed by those living in this kind of the bright, urban, successful areas of the country as the norm, and then that tend to overlook the pathologies that condition is creating for many of their fellow countrymen.
We're speaking with Patrick Deneen, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame in the United States, about his book, The Death of Liberalism. This is Late Night Live, and I'm Josh Sepps. Patrick, one of the interesting things about your book is the reaction that it's gotten. There have been so many reviews that I've read of it where people are terribly conflicted about it because it's a bit difficult to put in either political camp. When you talk about globalization, you say globalization is liberalism's handmaiden and engine. Well, that sounds like Bernie Sanders, and then there are other parts of the book that sound like they could be out of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. That could be a curse, but it could also be a blessing. Is there some kind of common ground that you see as being possible here?
Well, I do. And that's one of the hopes of my having written this book. I guess its limits are going to be exactly what you express, is a lot of the reviews that I've seen have said, I like half this book. So conservatives like the half of the book where I decry the decline of family and community and the encroachment and enlargement of the state into all aspects of life. And the liberals really like when I critique global capitalism and the depredations of many of our behaviors on the environment. And what I'm trying to show is that the things that are being sort of criticized on both sides are actually have their sources in this deeper sort of instantiation of this philosophy in that political water in which we swim. And what I'm beginning at least to see is some willingness to say, well, maybe there is a connection. Maybe there's a connection, for example, between a society that consumes so rapaciously that we now have essentially changed our climate and we are depleting many of the resources around the world, and a society that no longer, if we think of, for example, birth rates, is no longer able to even replace itself, is no longer willing to make the kinds of sacrifices to form families and to foster the next generation, that there's a connection between the things that tend to obsess the political right and the political left, that really reflects the realization of this vision of the autonomous, equally free human being.
It strikes me that part of what you're bemoaning is a lack of cultural and sort of educational awareness amongst people that this is even happening, that we're just sort of drifting through lives thinking that we're being given democratic choices when nobody is actually questioning the foundations on which those democratic choices rest. And one aspect that I'd like love you to tease out is the decline of liberal arts education, the decline of just teaching young people the value of the history of philosophy and of Western thought. Is it a problem that we're focusing so much on tailoring people towards jobs?
I'm glad you asked me that, because almost no one has paid any attention to that part of the book. And I think it's actually in some ways the most important part of the book, because what I'm really talking about, there's political systems, but much more central is sort of formation of the human person. And that formation takes place, obviously, first in families and then in our schools. And I've taught at some of the greatest institutions in the world. I've taught at Princeton, at Georgetown, now at the University of Notre Dame. And what I see among our students, even at these great institutions, is that they view their education completely in utilitarian terms of what it will do to get me a job. And so they're living very much in this fishbowl, right? Education, which is in some ways the formation of a generation, what we hope to pass on and the kind of world we hope to create, is being viewed in wholly individualistic terms in a utilitarian light of what will it get me? What will it do for me? And how will I secure my future in a very difficult and challenging economic and social world? The liberal arts tradition was premised on the idea that liberty was something that had to be learned. That's why it's called liberal arts. It's the art of learning to be free. You're not born free, as the Lockean conception posits. Freedom isn't a condition of doing as one wishes. Freedom is the condition of using one's liberty well. And so the assumption that liberty is simply attaining the ability to do as much as one can do through one's position and wealth and so forth, has had the pernicious effect of creating in its image then an education system in which we really do not offer our students this kind of very difficult kind of education, but it seems to me essential education on how it is that we use our liberty well. So just one example, when I talk with my students about environmental matters, when I talk with them, for example, about climate change, they tend almost always to move to discussions of technological and scientific fixes, right? That the solution lies in the extension of our control of nature. Now, let's face it, climate change was born of our impulse to control nature, of our impulse to use nature for our individual benefit. And so the first sort of response is not that I need to change my behavior, I need to alter how I live my life, but rather the first response tends to be, we will find the technological and scientific fix. I think reflects the complete lack of what a liberal arts education might be able to offer.
When you bemoan the idea of using nature for our benefit, though, you would also concede that the idea of using nature for our benefit, whilst it has caused pollution and now has thrust us into this position of a global crisis, it has also lifted hundreds of millions, nay, billions of people out of grinding poverty for the first time in human history, and has had enormous effects on our own prosperity, no?
Oh, I mean, doubtless, absolutely doubtless. But I think
do you think that this kind of attitude was something that we had to have but no longer need to have? Because clearly people had to be educated to think in these ways in order to have the Industrial Revolution and now the Information Revolution.
I suppose the revolution that we're talking about, though, is premised on an idea of a kind of limitless nature, as a kind of limitless bounty. And so I do think we are already, and we will have to face the very difficult questions of how we live in relatively higher degrees of prosperity in a condition in which we may have to think about those limits. And one of the things that's striking to me about the liberal order is that I think the liberal order would essentially collapse if growth economy ceased, if a growth economy was no longer possible. And that's in part because the titanic inequalities that are generated by the capitalist and, I think, more broadly, the liberal order are in a way justified and legitimated on the premise that everyone will have a kind of equal opportunity to make it and that the growth of the economy will allow for sufficient sort of generation of dynamic change that no one is, in a sense, stuck in their position. If that were to cease, I think the economic and political, certainly the political order, would lose its legitimacy. And we see that in a miniature form. I think we're still living in the aftermath of 2008 in the economic, pretty severe economic downturn, but that would be nothing in comparison to the cessation of a growth economy. So all this is to say that, yes, I agree completely, right, that this dynamic, now extensive, you could say use of nature, we could say exploitation of nature, has resulted in great increase of prosperity. But we are really faced with the difficult question of how this political and economic order continues if we face the fact of a limited globe.
I mean, there is clearly sufficient disillusionment to cause massive instability already, even when we do have periods of growth, or if we have a recession, it seems to be brief, no matter how bad the financial crisis was in 2008, 2009. We're all now a lot wealthier than we were prior to it, on average at least. So if we're already seeing flickers of populism, if we're already seeing Trump, and we're already seeing the disaffection that led to Brexit and similar kind of strains here in Australia, where we seem to go through a prime minister about every 3 months, what is the alternative to this? I mean, when you think about the alternative to liberalism, that would be illiberalism, that would be authoritarianism, maybe that would be communism. What's your alternative that is not those?
Well, I suppose, yeah, illiberal sounds terrible, and I would say it probably would be terrible under a certain understanding. I mean, what I've been arguing this whole time is that what we're describing as freedom may not be a condition of true freedom. It may in some ways be a condition in which we find ourselves in a new and an odd form of bondage. And here again, I'm echoing and repeating this kind of paradox that one finds in Alexis de Tocqueville, who concludes that at the end of democracy in America, that democracy may lead to a condition in which we think we're democratic, but we're no longer democratic. He calls it a condition of democratic despotism. And so what would it mean to be free? What would it mean to be free? And in an odd way, it may require a kind of a rethinking, and I think a reinvention of that more classical thinking of what freedom is. That freedom is achieving a condition in which we have ordered ourselves and our societies rightly. And that may mean the discipline of consumption, that may mean the discipline of ordering our lives around more local forms of governance and rule. It seems to me that when we talk about ourselves as democratic or as democracies, that's something that's true in name only. And the discontent you're reflecting in your kind of constant churning of prime ministers and that we're seeing in the American political system, I think comes about in significant part because people don't feel that they control their political order any longer. They're told they do, but they don't. So what would it take to give people that sense that they actually control their fates and through their political and civic lives kind of exercise the muscles of self-government? Well, here again, Tocqueville argued that it would have to be relatively more local forms of self-rule. That's obviously a challenge in a globalized age. I don't have a blueprint or a map to get there, but I do think it's something that we have to put on the table as that which will viably defend forms of liberty if the alternative becomes truly illiberalism.
Can a transition to such a world happen peacefully and slowly, or does it require a break?
My own preference would be peacefully and slowly.
I didn't ask for preference,
yeah,
Patrick.
Yeah, that would be my preference. Can it happen? I don't know. The future is unwritten. I would simply say the following, that if you start a journey, and it's likely to be a long journey, and it's taken us 500 years to get here, it's a very bad idea simply to say that, I expect to get there immediately. But when you start a journey, you begin moving in that direction. You start with a few steps that move in that direction. And so I suppose at the end of the day, my more radical analysis elicits in what I would think would be relatively modest kinds of proposals, not because I think that's where we would end, but it's where we would have to begin. And so I see this as not too many of my readers say what's next, and I say we're at the beginning of a very long and I hope a peaceful, but probably a very long process of having to live rather differently and think rather differently about ourselves.
I have not yet read a review of your book that doesn't have a major problem with it. You mentioned earlier that people usually like half of it and don't like half of it, depending on their political persuasion. And I imagine that any time someone challenges an orthodoxy as widespread as liberalism, the way that you are, people are going to find it hard to swallow. So last question, what is the question that you get asked by in interviews or the criticism that you see from reviewers that most annoys you?
I suppose it's what I said earlier, which was those critics who say, you seem to be entirely right except when you criticize my liberalism, whether it's the market or whether it's the advance of what you raised earlier, the advance of the open and equal society of individuals in the kind of open world. So the more social forms of liberalism. It's what it reflects to me is that we are deeply enmeshed in system maintenance, in regime maintenance, and we'll seek to maintain this regime in whatever way we can, even if it means I won't sufficiently hear you to reflect on whether or not my own commitments are in fact connected to the things that most that I most oppose politically.
Yeah, I'll glaze right, over the pages that I disagree with and exactly. Just nod vigorously when I agree. Right. Look, I felt the same way. It is a fascinating and occasionally infuriating book, but thank you for writing it, Patrick, and thanks for being on the show.
I appreciate it. I'm glad I was at least infuriating. I appreciate it.
You got it. That's Patrick Deneen, who's a political scientist at the University of Notre Dame in the United States, talking about his book, The Death of Liberalism. You're listening to Late Night Live. I'm Josh Sepps, filling in for Philip Adams. And now let's head to the Savoy Hotel in London, a favourite hangout for Russian spies in the 1920s. Jack Hilton and his orchestra are bringing the house down with a bouncy tune, A Wonderful You. If you've been paying any attention to the news lately, you'll be aware that the way top-secret Australian documents get leaked is by being flogged off inside an old piece of office furniture. So that's one way to do it. There are more sinister ways of acquiring top-secret intel, the good old-fashioned spy. And while the Americans continue to investigate Russia's clandestine influence on the last US election, the British historian Tim Phillips has uncovered an extraordinary trove of cloak-and-dagger tales of Russian spies in London, not during the Cold War, but in the very earliest days of the Soviet Union, in London's Jazz Age. His book is called The Secret Twenties, British Intelligence, the Russians and the Jazz Age. And Tim, I believe you researched it without buying a single old filing cabinet from a second-hand furniture shop. Where did you get the MI5 files that inspired this book?
Yes, if I do another book, I'll definitely go to secondhand shops first.
Just come to Canberra. It's so easy.
In this case, I had to go to the National Archives of the United Kingdom in Kew in West London. Quite unusually for an international, for a national spy agency, MI5 decided from the late 90s on to start declassifying groups of its documents from its historic archives. And the 1920s is the era for which the largest number of archives, largest number of files have been declassified, so I decided to go and look through them, initially out of interest, and then I got hooked and decided that there was definitely a book in there.
And your main expertise is actually Russian history, right? Not British history. So were you looking through this period in London through the prism of Russia's interests?
Initially, yes. I had written a previous book about contemporary Russia, the Caucasus and Chechnya and that sort of thing. And I decided, was taking a break from that and wanted to look at something that was Russian-related but also Britain-related and got into these archives. And knowing Russian was very useful because a number of the secret letters that MI5 and Special Branch, Metropolitan Police Special Branch, intercepted were written in Russian, but also obviously there was a lot of other stuff besides that was in English.
So what was the relationship like between the two countries at the time? Obviously, 1917, you'd had the Bolshevik Revolution. I assume that the elites in the UK were freaking out in much the same way that elites all over the world were at that revolution and the possibility of communism becoming a real threat. How did the Russians respond?
You're absolutely right. There was initially a lot of anger in countries like Australia and Britain about the Bolsheviks pulling Russia's armed forces out of the First World War. So that was the first reason, I guess, that people were angry at the Bolsheviks. And then, of course, looking beyond that, their ideology required them to try and seek revolutions, to stir up revolutions everywhere else around the world. So they seemed pretty toxic from the perspective of the West. Russia itself, it was a bit... schizophrenic might be a word to use, because it wanted to be recognized. The Bolsheviks wanted to be recognized as the legitimate government of Russia. So on the diplomatic front, they did try and get recognition from countries like Britain and America and Australia. But all the while, they were also trying to hostile propaganda into those countries, and also to send in secret agents and to send funding, a lot of funding, to communist parties in countries like Australia and Britain that would otherwise have struggled to survive, because many of them had very small memberships. Mm. But there was a lot of money coming, a lot of it actually from jewels that had been requisitioned from Russian aristocrats and princes and princesses, and then were smuggled out and liquidated on the black market, and that money was then used to prop up foreign communist parties.
When we look back from long after the end of the Cold War on the history of the 20th century, and we sort of know the outcome, it's a little bit like hindsight is 20/20. So I kind of know how the story unfolds. But can you put me in the shoes of someone in the 1920s and what they made of the nature of communism? Because, I mean, this was the first era when, you write this, when the fight between socialism and conservatism really became predominant. They didn't know there was going to be a Cold War. They didn't know what was going to happen.
That's right. I've called it the first Cold War, and someone else who interviewed me on the radio had an even better phrase, which I wish I'd thought of, which was that it was the first freeze. I think for I think one of the things that's an interesting echo of today is that some people chose to focus on the intentions of communists. So the intention was to destroy the known social order, to redistribute wealth completely from top to bottom in society, and to end the kind of liberal democracies that were developing in many countries. If you focused on the intention, which is what a lot of people on the right of societies like Britain did in the 1920s, then you were really up in arms about Russia and very genuinely frightened. You know, you probably thought that actually communist Russia was much more frightening than the Kaiser's Germany had been. If, however, you focused on the impact that communists were able to have, then you might be less worried, because what you would see is that, you know, in a country like Britain, Communist Party membership was often around 2,000 to 3,000 people, you know, out of a population of 30 to 40 million, and they didn't actually have great success either in elections or even in taking over things like trade unions. So it really depends on whether you focus on the intention or the impact.
Well, it also depends on who you think communists are, because if you think that communists are only people who join the Communist Party, then that's one thing. But if you think that communists are anyone who joins any kind of a labour movement, including the Labour Party itself, which at the time, of course, had never held the prime ministership, then the election of 1924, what do the MI5 files that you've accessed show about the elite establishment's reaction to that?
Huge fear from MI5, MI6, Special Branch, from a large part of the Conservative Party, from leading public figures like Winston Churchill, who at that time was still a liberal only just and about to become a Conservative again, from newspapers like the Daily Mail. In January 1924, many of these people think that the world as they know it is about to come to an end, and they genuinely are frightened that if Labour gets a hold of Downing Street, within months they'll be begging on the streets or going into exile.
And it sounds ridiculous now, but again, like there was a concern that the Labour Party could be a Trojan horse for communism, and at the time the Soviet Union was only 7 years old, so it was conceivable that what had happened there could happen in the UK. No,
I'm not sure. I think everything that Labour had done when it had power in the past, so it had been invited into the war cabinet of the whole of the United Kingdom in the 1910s, and it had, of course, held power in many local councils before 1924. Everything it had done up to that point suggested that it, you know, largely was a Christian socialist kind of organisation and very gradualist. And actually, the people who would have been most sympathetic towards Bolshevik Russia within the Labour movement were constantly deeply frustrated by their leadership, as has often been the case since in labour movements around the world. So the fear was real. There's very little grounds, I think, for saying that it was also rational.
Right, fair enough. We all remember that before the last US presidential election, the director of the FBI, James Comey, released an infamous letter which the Clinton campaign believes tanked the election for them 11 days before the election. Well, 4 days before the election of 1924, you tell the story about how the conservative intelligence establishment undermined their government with another piece of fake news. What was that?
Yeah, it really was very similar echoes. So it's called the Zinoviev letter. And if you know a little bit about this but haven't gone into the detail of it, as many of your listeners may well, it's easy to think that the problem was that the Zinoviev letter itself was a fake. And that's true. So it had been faked up in probably in the Baltic states by some white Russians who opposed the Bolsheviks.
And what was the letter?
From Lev Zinoviev, the head of the Comintern, which was the international wing of the Bolsheviks, to the Communist Party in Great Britain. And in the letter it said, what we need you to do now is to act on your many connections in the Labour Party and get them to stir up all kinds of trouble so that they agitate for Labour in government to make closer ties between Britain and the Soviet Union. So it was the kind of letter that implied a sort of fifth column in British society. And they also talked, Zinoviev in this fake letter, as it was, also said that they should act on the cells that they had created in the army and the navy. The letter came in to MI6 and then was shared with MI5 and Special Branch, and they decided that it was genuine without really checking, even though there had been many forgeries before. And this was all taking place at the start of a sort of 6 to 8 week election campaign. And they immediately called on Ramsay MacDonald to condemn the letter, to throw the Soviet representatives in Britain, the diplomatic representatives, out, and basically to repudiate all of his policy of trying to have closer but moderate ties with Russia. Ramsay MacDonald, who was the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary, quite unusually, he said, I want you to tell me that the letter's genuine because there have been fakes before and I don't want to kind of, you know, jump to this and then find out I'm wrong. They came back very quickly and said, yeah, it's definitely genuine, we've checked it out, but they hadn't. Then with sort of 4 days to go till the election, when he was still mulling over what to do, and he was right, of course, because it was a fake, the intelligence agencies decided that he was trying to delay releasing word of the letter until after the election, and they leaked it to the Daily Mail and to a number of others, including all the police chiefs in the country and many conservative politicians. And they said that he had deliberately covered it up and tried to subvert democracy, and he was planning to cozy up to Russia much more if he got back in.
And the Daily Mail published this supposed directive from Moscow to British communists.
Published it under a headline that said that the Labour Prime Minister had sought to cover it up, and the Daily Mail was bringing the news to everybody. Yes, that's right.
Some of the stories that you tell in the book, I'm speaking with Tim Phillips, by the way, who's a historian, about his book The Secret Twenties, which is about Russian spies in London in the 1920s in the Jazz Age. You're listening to Late Night Live, and I'm Josh Sepps. Some of these stories, Tim, they read like the Mad Magazine comic of spy versus spy. One is the story of Johnny Walker. Tell us why he is so fascinating.
So Johnny Walker is probably my favourite discovery over the many years I worked in the archives. And that's because there's been very little known about him previously. And in the back of his fifth file, he has five files in the archives. And in the back of the fifth one, we get his confession, first person confession, which was given to the FBI in the 1950s as part of the kind of McCarthyite witch hunt, if you like. But he tells his whole story from 1910 onwards in his own voice. And the 1920s part is that he's commissioned by the Comintern to smuggle himself into Britain along with his wife, Valley. They come via a very dangerous route through the north of Norway, across the Arctic Ocean on a little ship, and the ship in front of them sinks with 13 French communists on it, but they manage to get across, smuggles himself into the north of England, sets himself up as a kind of a halfway house for propaganda coming out of the Soviet Union and entering Britain, also as a connection point for secret messages being sent to Comintern agents around the world. And finally, as a military espionage person, he's one of the first people to try and get military secrets in Britain. What's really interesting about him is that he goes undetected in Britain. MI5 and MI6 don't spot him for 4 years, and he manages to get himself in and out of the country a number of times on a fake passport, which really shows how weak the country's defences are. And when they finally spot that he's there in 1925, it kind of sparks off a bit of a headless chicken-like crisis.
Why were they so bad?
Well, I guess to be charitable to them, MI5 and MI6 had only existed for about 10 years. They were mostly used to working in wartime when they had much easier access to kind of, draconian legislation that allowed them to do whatever they liked. And then in peacetime, it was difficult to adjust. They had to deal with austerity and big cuts. To be less charitable to them, I think, there's an amateurishness that many professions have in their early stages, and when you look back in hindsight, it looks rather comical. And of course, also they really had a big problem with groupthink. They tended to employ only people who had come out of a small number of private schools in the south of England and served a bit of time in the army or the navy and liked to spend their weekends hunting, shooting and fishing. So they didn't have a lot of kind of fresh ideas being put in at their weekly brainstorm meeting.
There are, of course, other problems with intelligence work, which are just fundamental to the whole question of how you find out things that you don't even know you need to find out and not let things go past you that you do need to notice. I mean, we now live in a world that is so much more complicated than it was in the 1920s, where information is speeding around at such a faster rate and where the capacity for one power to undermine our lives is so much greater just with the stroke of a keyboard. What are some of those fundamental things that we are still trying to grapple with? You make the good point that it's said about advertising that half of the money that is spent on advertising is wasted, but nobody knows which half it is, and that's sort of the same with intelligence.
That's right. I think you make a really good point bringing it into the present day. And I guess lots of us think about cyber attacks when we think about that, and probably also about Twitter and these, Twitter farms that have allegedly sprung up in Russia with lots of bots who are tweeting things trying to influence Western elections. It's a very hard question to answer. What's the real impact here? We do know that states can attack each other, as you say, with the stroke of a keyboard and do real damage. And equally, we might well suspect that even if it's troubling that a country wants to employ loads of graduates to tweet fake news about the American election or the French election or the referendum in the UK, we might still be wondering what impact did that really have? Did that really swing those votes? I think what the 1920s shows is that it's very easy for people who are shocked by how society is changing more generally to decide that the thing to blame is a foreign agent or a foreign country or a foreign ideology, when actually the way that society is changing is the reasons for society changing are much more complex than that, and probably most of them are rooted closer to home.
Mm. By closer to home, do you mean our own agencies or do you mean just our lives?
Well, I guess if I keep talking about the 1920s, but it's easy to see the how it reads through to today. I mean, our own lives. I mean, in the 1920s, people were dealing with the trauma of the greatest war that had ever happened. Many people had lost families and loved ones. They'd realized in a new way that life was potentially very brutal and very short. And there had also been a kind of shake-up in the rules of deference. And so you start to see, you know, among younger generations, lots of new forms of self-expression, more impatience with the idea of sort of behaving morally because that's what you should do, lots more doubt about religion. And you also see in the case of Britain that it has its biggest ever empire after the Treaty of Versailles, but it's an empire that it can't really afford to have and can't really afford to police adequately. So when things went wrong in the empire or when groups of people wanted to go and have sexual relations in a new way, there were people who wanted to write into the newspapers and blame all of that on Moscow, but actually that's not the case. Moscow would have loved to have had that much power, but it didn't.
And do you think that we're similarly overblowing it today?
I think like your analogy with advertising, it's very hard to say, but what always worries me is when people don't stop to ask themselves that question and instead they kind of tie into their rhetoric because it serves their purposes, the idea that, you know, and there's this going on in Russia and there's this going on as well and China's doing this and et cetera, et cetera. So what comforts me is when people say, well, let's just stop a minute and, you know, what has that really achieved, or is that really going to change the way things are, or, you know, were things going that way anyway? I also think that, you know, one of the things that's changed since the 1920s is that the amount of our information that is written down, either by typing it in messages or whatever, is much greater, actually, than it was almost 100 years ago. You know, many more of our conversations take place in ways that are recordable. Mm. And so the relationship between private life, privacy and secrecy has changed a lot. One of the things that shocked me in the archives is how many times you come across personal letters or transcripts of telephone conversations that took place between two people who weren't themselves suspects, but they just kind of got caught up in this net. And so these are conversations or letters that they would have assumed were private, but then they became secret because they were taken on by MI5 and put in the secret archives. And when the archives are declassified, they then become public. Hmm. So it's a weird thing that, you know, the route from privacy to public knowledge could be through secrecy. But I think that's what you see with this. And who knows in the future what might happen with that? You know, is there a complete dossier somewhere in the world of everything that has been sent on WhatsApp or on Facebook Messenger, you know, that one day may be released?
I believe that every tweet is now housed in the Library of Congress in the United States. So don't say anything on Twitter that you don't want archived by the Yanks. Tim, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That is Tim Phillips, who's a historian and a regular contributor to the Times Literary Supplement and to the BBC Russian Service. On Monday, Laura Tingle will be here on Canberra Politics, James Button on how the consensus on immigration in Australia has disappeared, and Professor Elizabeth Kendall from Oxford University will tell us about new developments in the war in Yemen. I'm Josh Sepps, and this is Late Night Live. Have a great weekend.